Welcome to the America's Workforce Radio Podcast, the flagship production of the American Workers Radio and Podcast Network, where organized labor and its never-ending fight to protect the rights of the American worker come first. Now, presented by LIUNA, Laborers International Union of North America, here's your host, Ed Flash Ferens.
It's safety first, California standing up for workers, and it's all because of the UFCW. Meanwhile, child labor violations at some Mickey D's restaurants in the state of Idaho. And today on the show, the latest from the Ohio Federation of Teachers and the National Employment Law Project. Good afternoon and welcome to the Tuesday, September 15th edition of America's Workforce, where we are available on various platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Google Play, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Twitter handle, AWF Union Podcast. Two guests on the show today, Melissa Cropper will be joining us on behalf of the Ohio Federation of Teachers, which is part of the American Federation of Teachers, OFT-AFT.org is their website. Melissa's going to talk about two things, what the federal government is doing and should be doing, and what the state government is trying to do to keep students safe. The Trump administration, she says, is failing our schools again. Here's the problem. They are refusing to waive federal testing requirements, despite the fact that we're in the middle of a pandemic. She says schools need to be able to focus this year primarily on safety, right? Makes a lot of sense for students, for teachers, for staff, for communities. And also, they need to support the students' social and emotional learning needs. Think about this. Kids are scared. Of course, they're scared of when they take a test. We don't need to throw that on them right now. And we're over-testing anyway. Now, also related to testing, the Ohio Federation supports a number of provisions in a state-sponsored piece of legislation. This is SB 358. And this legislation would seek federal waivers from high-stakes testing and hold districts harmless from what's called the report card benchmarks for 2020-21. Give us some flexibility, put it that way. She's going to give us some details on that. Overall, the bill is pretty good, says Melissa, except for one thing. Lawmakers decided to provide additional private school vouchers. And if you've been listening to our conversations with Melissa Cropper, this always seems to pop up in the legislature, not just in Ohio, but virtually every state in the country. Got to have more vouchers. Got to have school flexibility. So Melissa will be our first guest. Debbie Berkowitz, on behalf of the National Employment Law Project, will be joining us as her second guest. And she's quite fascinating. She spent, my gosh, 6 years at the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. All right, OSHA. She is currently the Worker Safety and Health Program Director at the National Employment Law Project. She worked at OSHA from 2009 to 2015. She's got a long record of achievement in the field of occupational safety and health. And since she joined the National Employment Labor Project, her efforts have been to strengthen federal and state worker safety and health protections. And as you know, we're not getting much help on the federal level. So they're going state by state. And we've done several shows on this. Virginia, for one. Michigan is another one where states have taken it upon themselves to help workers out. Because as you know, and we did a show on this yesterday, if you speak out on the job, say people aren't wearing their masks or any kind of protective equipment, you could be fired. That's what kind of environment we're living in the middle of a pandemic. Great organization, NELP.org. NELP.org is a website. So Debbie Berkowitz will be joining us as her second guest. Following a comprehensive complaint filed by the United Food and Commercial Workers, Local 770, the California Division of Occupational Safety and Health, Cal OSHA, has issued its largest coronavirus citation in the state, fining food processing company Overhill Farms and its staffing agency more than $200,000 for serious health and safety violations. It should not be so dangerous to go to work every day. I commend the leadership of the workers at Overhill for speaking up in the face of atrocious safety violations at the plant and for creating an innovative safety committee at Overhill. That comment from John Grant, who's president of Local 770. He said, without their leadership, even more workers would be sick. John goes on to say, now the state of California has weighed in with meaningful citations that show just how dangerous the working conditions were. One worker at Overhill died from COVID-19 in April, and more than 1,100 members of Local 770 have tested positive for the virus. Cal OSHA specifically cited Overhill because its employees have been unable to maintain physical distance at several points on the job place. Now, this goes completely opposite to the story we talked about yesterday at Smithfield, the pork processor, where the federal department of OSHA fined them, what was it, $13,000? And they've had, I believe, like 1,300 people sick. Four people died. Again, the states have to pick up the ball on this. Darmody Enterprises, LTD, is the owner and operator of McDonald's restaurants in Idaho, and they have paid $50,000 in civil penalties for their violation of child labor requirements of the Fair Labor Standards Act at 11 locations in the state. The franchises violated child labor requirements at 11 restaurants by allowing 14 and 15-year-old employees to work more than 3 hours during school days, past 7 p.m. during school days, past 9 p.m. This happened from June 1st through Labor Day, more than 8 hours per day on non-school days, and to operate manual fryer baskets, also a violation. Wow, it's like a third world nation there. Finally, one of the franchises failed to maintain accurate proof of age in one minor employee, which is also a violation of the Labor Standards Act. And this is coupled with a lawsuit you might have heard about where scores of black former franchisees of McDonald's filed suit in federal court saying the company treated black partners differently, providing misleading data. And they steered them toward bad locations. Average annual sales of black-run McDonald's franchises was about $700,000 below the national average. And the number of black franchisees has decreased by about half since 1998, even as the number of global stores doubled. So this, by the way, is the third major racial discrimination lawsuit against McDonald's this year. The current suit seeks up to $5 million per plaintiff to account for lost revenue and accrued debt. All right, we have to take a break. You're listening to America's Workforce. Our segment with the Ohio Federation of Teachers coming up next. Don't go away.
This is America's Workforce. More shows available at awfradio.com.
Lyona, the Laborers International Union of North America, is the most progressive, aggressive, and fastest-growing union of construction workers, and one of the most diverse and effective unions representing public service employees. LIUNA members are on the forefront of the construction industry, a sector that is a powerhouse of 12 million workers producing 5% of our country's economic output, a half million strong. We're united through collective bargaining agreements which help us earn family-supporting pay, good benefits, and the opportunity for advancement and better lives. With Mobile Action LIUNA, you can get updates on your cell phone, find out how to sign petitions, and download union ringtones. Be a part of your union's political and organizing efforts by sending a text message on your cell phone with the word LIUNA to the number 69866. Through the LIUNA Action Network, you can stay informed about your union with a one-minute update and action alerts.
America's Workforce is being brought to you in part by the Communication Workers of America.
America's Workforce appreciates our sponsor, the Columbus Central Ohio Building and Construction Trades Council, who represents more than 18,000 workers from 19 affiliated local unions and district councils.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And we're back. It's America's Workforce, where we're available on various platforms, and that includes Apple Podcasts, Google Play, iHeartRadio, Spotify. Once again, we ask that you subscribe to our podcast network. Anyone you want to pick, eventually you'll get hooked on them, and please give us a rating. A 5-star rating would be very much appreciated. Before we get to our first guest, Melissa Cropper, on behalf of the Ohio Federation of Teachers, I have to mention here, during the Republican National Convention a couple of weeks ago, the American Federation of Teachers tried to run an ad going after Trump and Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, for their failure to provide adequate personal protective equipment to educators and provide a plan for a safe return to public schools during the outbreak. Well, the ad was supposed to run on Fox News, and it was run by the union's PAC, Political Action Committee. In the spot, the commercial, the union shows classrooms and schools and said enough is enough. This November, say no to Trump and McConnell's chaos. According to the union, they were going to spend about $180,000 to air the commercial during the Wednesday and Thursday nights of the convention. The union also spent $34,000 to run the ad on CNN. CNN had no problem, but Fox rejected it, saying it included a questionable claim. What was so controversial? Well, according to the AFT, Fox advertising staff said that legal rejected the ad because they wanted a more concise argument about how Trump and McConnell were responsible for developing a plan for students to return to school. Randy Weingarten, president of the AFT, said, "It seems executives want to pick and choose how to apply the First Amendment when it comes to brave teachers telling the truth about who's to blame for the current chaos of school reopenings." So what is Fox really afraid of? We need resources and supports to keep our students safe as we reopen. People should know who is and who is not helping. All right, let's go to Melissa Cropper, president of the OFT. I'm sure, Melissa, welcome back to the show. Thanks for joining us. I guess you're not surprised by what you're hearing here from Fox News. What's your thoughts?
No, I mean, I guess partially surprised in that, you know, we are still a democratic society, and you would think that we'd be able to run commercials about things on any network we want to run commercials on. But then, no, not surprised, because it's Fox News, and obviously our commercial didn't fit their agenda. And so they found reasons not to support it, which is very sad in many ways. But it's indicative of the times that we live in right now.
Boy, you're not kidding. So polarizing, including the media. That's the sad part about that. All right. Today, you want to talk about testing. And there's two fronts here. There's the Trump administration. There's what's going on in the State House. Let's start off with the Trump administration. Apparently, they are refusing to waive the federal testing requirements for students in public schools. Explain this part to me, Melissa.
Yes. So now we're going back to testing in terms of how we used to always talk about testing in terms of assessing students. So, you know, last year when the pandemic hit, we all asked for waivers from state testing, the mandated state testing, given that the students weren't in school and there had been a disruption to learning, et cetera. And the federal government granted that waiver. Well, obviously, we are not out of that situation yet. If anything, things are in some ways more chaotic this year, because there's a lot of back and forth about we're remote for a while, we might be hybrid for a while, might be in person for a while. And we're still all struggling with how to return kids to school safely and how to actually prepare kids during this time. So again, states have been asking for a waiver from these state testing. And this year, Betsy DeVos in the U.S. Department of Education saying that they refused to grant those waivers, which just shows a real lack of understanding and concern for what's happening in our classrooms right now.
So what can be done about this? I mean, is there a way to override this? What recourse do we have right now?
Well, I mean, the only recourse we have, which is the recourse we seem to have to keep falling back on, is we all have to mobilize and be lobbying the federal government to make a change on this. And I think it's really important for teachers and superintendents and parents to all speak out at this time and say that, you know, this is not what we want for our children right now. You know, I think it's important to point out, because there's a big distinction here that needs to be made, in that all educators believe that we should be assessing students to find out, you know, where they stand, how much has learning been disrupted, where do we need to pick up with learning, you know, what's working, what's not working. This is the kind of informal assessments that we do all the time and that are absolutely critical. But what we need a waiver from are these mandated state tests that are really used for the purpose of making judgments about schools. And I firmly believe that one of the reasons Betsy DeVos keeps pushing this is because these tests are often used to grant vouchers. And so she needs a way to label schools as failing so that students are eligible for vouchers to go to private schools, which her whole agenda has been privatization. And so this is her way to be able to do that. And obviously that's just not what we need at this point in time, given where we are with the pandemic.
Yeah. There's always a bigger picture involved. And we're going to get to the vouchers here in the state of Ohio. Talk to me about, speaking of which, Senate Bill 358. Now, this is also related to testing, and you support, and you've testified on behalf of this bill, you support a lot of the provisions, except for the voucher part. Let's start with what you support.
Of course.
There's always something in the way, and it's usually the voucher.
I know. I always have to throw in these little pieces that are problematic. But overall, Senate Bill 358 is a good bill that, again, shows an understanding of the times that we are in. So this is really a continuation of a bill that was passed last year that granted waivers around the state testing and around teacher evaluations, results report cards, et cetera, and understanding that given that learning is being disrupted and that we're trying to learn new ways to do these things, it's not a time to be making judgment calls about teachers or schools. It's a time to be supporting and trying to do things the best way possible. So 358 would allow the state to ask the federal government for a waiver from tests, because the state actually itself cannot grant that waiver. They have to ask for the feds. So this was just simply going to allow the State Department to ask Betsy DeVos for a waiver, which she's now saying she's not going to give. But it also would grant the state, which the state can do, grant a waiver around evaluations this year and around the results of report cards, which, again, report cards in Ohio are used to make decisions about vouchers, about going into academic distress commission, and those type of things. So we support this bill because we really feel like the focus right now needs to be on how do we provide education, how do we do it in a remote situation, how do we do it in a hybrid situation, and we just think that there needs to be some flexibility to be able to focus on those things rather than trying to jump through the hoops of meeting all these state mandates at this point in time.
One of the points that you testified on was graduation flexibility, and apparently you're saying that students who are on track to graduate should not be held back due to disruptions caused by the pandemic. Is that happening right now? I mean, are kids being kind of like pulled back because of what's going on right now?
That could be the potential if some adjustments aren't made to the law, because there are certain tests that have to be passed and, you know, accumulation of points based upon how you scored on different state-mandated tests, et cetera, that are part of graduation requirements. So, again, this is an extension of last year when students weren't able to take this test or learning got disrupted in the last few months. The state said at that point in time, listen, if it looked like a student was going to graduate and the student was on track to graduate, then let's not hold that student back. It's more harmful to a student to hold them back than to maybe graduate someone who didn't exactly have the highest score possible. And we're asking that continue this year. Again, we don't know what the school year holds. We could see schools back in session. Schools are in session now, but we could see schools back face to face in a month. Those that are remote, but then it could be in for a few weeks and out again. So it's this real roller coaster of learning this year. And again, we want to focus on making sure that students are learning as much as possible. But given all these ebbs and flows, we want to make sure that that students aren't punished in some way because of all these disruptions that happen. So we want to push students to be the very best they can be this year, but at the same time, when it comes time to graduate, we want to be a little bit more understanding of the circumstances and making those decisions about who graduates and who doesn't.
Yeah, man, teachers have enough on their plate.
Long-term consequences to not getting your diploma.
Yeah,
so we
exactly.
want to make sure that students
Boy,
are getting.
You're not kidding. Yeah, there's so much that teachers have to deal with in the middle of a pandemic. Talk to me a little bit more about the evaluation of teachers. Now, normally they would be evaluated. You're asking for some flexibility there for this time?
Right. So normally there's a whole procedure that teachers have to go through where they're being observed and they're having meetings with the principal or super or whoever the evaluator is. And again, being evaluated on what their teaching looks like and what kind of progress they're making. Now, what we're saying is we still want those kind of meetings to happen in terms of we still want to be looking at how we're doing in this situation. But again, tying the consequences to that in a time when teachers are basically having to relearn what they do, we just don't think it's a fair assessment to make determinations about a teacher's quality during a time when, in a lot of ways, they're first-year teachers this year. and again, there's a lot of steps that go into that evaluation process that take up time. And even in normal circumstances, administrators and other people were complaining about the amount of time that this takes. And to try to fit this in when we're already struggling with doing all these other pieces is really difficult. Plus, to be quite honest about it, I'm not sure that we have evaluators who understand remote learning well enough to be able to accurately determine whether someone's doing a good job with remote instruction or not. So again, we feel like the time would be better spent this year in providing professional development to teachers on how to continue to hone their abilities at doing remote learning and to support each other, observe each other, learn from each other, and coach each other in those ways rather than jumping through these hoops of doing evaluations that are going to be used for accountability purposes.
So, Melissa, overall, Senate Bill 358 is pretty decent. Again, there's one problem, and that has to do with the vouchers. And this, from what I'm reading, would provide Ed Choice vouchers to anyone who is not a current recipient. Is that what's included in this legislation then?
Right. Again, there's a nuance here, and this is a continuation of what was happening last year, where supposedly there was a freeze on new vouchers until we figure out a solution to the whole voucher problem. But that freeze turned out to not actually be a freeze for districts who are currently voucher eligible. And 358 would continue that from last year. The problem with that is that, like I said, it allows We are okay with saying that for now, until we fix the voucher problem, any student who is receiving a voucher can continue to receive a voucher. But what this does is says that anyone who is a sibling of someone who receives a voucher would automatically get one. So that's a whole lot of kindergartners coming into school. Or anyone who could have taken a voucher before in these schools but chose not to, but now decide they want to take one, they could take a voucher. So again, we're seeing in some of these schools, because of the hundreds of new kindergartners coming in, or parents choosing to go to a private school because they're face-to-face and their home district might be remote learning, we're seeing an increase in the number of students who are taking vouchers. So again, this is draining money from these districts, because we have to keep in mind that our funding formula has been frozen. So often these schools are not getting money for these students, but they're paying out money when these students decide to leave. So we're just asking that a freeze be an actual freeze. And if you didn't receive a voucher before, you don't receive one now until we get through this pandemic and we figure out what we're doing about vouchers in this state, especially now when schools are, we need so many resources just to address the issues that surround this pandemic. We really can't afford to have this money going out the door for voucher students.
I hear you. Okay, Melissa, we're going to button it up there. Again, the piece of legislation is Senate Bill 358. You can get some more information on the OFT and their website, oft-aft.org. You can also follow them on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/OFT Union. Twitter handle, OFT Advocate. a lot of ways to check into the Ohio Federation of Teachers. Melissa, you take care. Be safe. We'll talk to you next month, okay?
Thank you.
All right. Quick break. When we come back, Debbie Berkowitz on behalf of the National Employment Law Project talking about worker safety right here on America's Workforce. Back in a few minutes.
This is America's Workforce.
There is unity and strength for workers.
We are the USW.
We are the USW.
The United Steelworkers.
The largest industrial union in North America.
We represent 850,000 members in the U.S., Canada, and the Caribbean.
We work in metals,
rubber,
chemicals,
paper,
oil refining,
atomic energy, and the service sector.
We are steelworkers, standing strong and fighting for what's right.
The Heat and Frost Insulators and Allied Workers are proud to be a title sponsor for America's Workforce Radio. The Insulators Union is leading the way in the mechanical insulation industry, fire stopping, and infectious disease control. Regarded as North America's energy conservation specialists, these professionals are known for their professional work and dedication. You can learn more about the Insulators Union at insulators.org.
America's Workforce Radio is sponsored in part by the International Union of Painters and Allied Trades, District Council 6, representing painters, glazers, drywall finishers, and sign and display industry workers. They remind you that belonging to a union is your right as an American.
The United Auto Workers are one of the largest and most diverse unions in North America, with members in virtually every sector of the economy. Learn more about this proud sponsor of our program at UAW.org.
Now, back to Ed Flash Ferens with America's Workforce.
Hey, we're back. It's America's Workforce. You can find us on various platforms, including Apple, Google Play, Spotify. iHeartRadio is another one of them. And don't forget our Twitter handle, AWF Union Podcast. You can follow us there. Let's go to line number two. And I've been trying to track this woman down for at least 6-7 weeks. Debbie Berkowitz is her name. And once you start listening to what she has to say, you'll understand why it took so long to track her down. She is the program director of worker safety and health for the National Employment Law Project. She joined NELP back in 2015, actually, following 6 years serving as chief of staff and then senior policy advisor for the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, better known as OSHA. She was there from 2009 to 2015. You'll recall that's when President Barack Obama was in office. So let's go to our live line and welcome her because she is one busy lady. We are very, very fortunate to have her on talking about what's going on and what's not going on with regard to worker safety in America. Debbie Berkowitz, welcome to America's Workforce. Thanks for joining us.
I'm honored to be on, and I'm so glad it worked out.
Yeah, really. We have a lot to talk about. I want to get into your background here a little bit more. I referenced your work at OSHA. That had to be an interesting position for you, and maybe you could just chat with us a little bit about that and reflect on those years compared to OSHA today. Big difference there. Talk to me about that part.
Oh, yeah. It's like night and day. And I guess one of the best comparisons has to do with, you know, the COVID-19 outbreak. And when I first got to OSHA in 2009, there was an outbreak, an H1N1, another infectious disease that at the time was affecting, you know, hospital workers and healthcare workers. And we needed to make sure that they were protected on the job. And we immediately, you know, moved into action. We worked with CDC to come up with very clear provisions that employers have to implement to protect workers. And then OSHA decided to enforce those provisions. Now what you have is the CDC coming out with very vague recommendations that's just guidance to employers that says, if possible, can you do this, please? And then if it's not possible, there's nothing else that they need to do. And you have OSHA not coming out with any of its own requirements and not enforcing the CDC guidelines. In addition, right now under OSHA, because they have failed to replace staff that retires or leaves, they now have the least number of inspectors in the history of the agency. And they're also doing a greatly reduced number of inspections total, and really have done almost no on-site inspections during COVID-19.
That is so wrong. When you say they're failing to follow, like, for instance, the CDC guidelines, is that something like against the law, or they don't have any direction? There's no mandate saying they have to follow those guidelines? Is that what's going on?
Right. CDC just issues guidance, and employers can follow it or they can ignore it. And OSHA's not enforcing it. Plus, if folks go to the CDC website and look for their guidance for businesses, you'll see that a lot of it says, please, you know, give workers masks if possible. Please socially distance if possible. You know, it doesn't say do this. And if you can't do this, do something else. I mean, what you want from CDC is what you need to do to mitigate the spread of COVID-19 at work. So then workers can take this to the employer as opposed to something that's like gobbledygook of sorts. But right, it's just advisory. Employers can follow it or they can ignore it.
Yeah. And a lot of workers are speaking out about this, and apparently they're being disciplined, in some cases actually fired. And from what I've been gathering, Trump's National Labor Relations Board is allowing that to happen. I'm sure you're getting an earful on your end at the National Employment Law Project on that.
Oh, sure. We've actually just taken a look at some of the data that we have looked over at OSHA and the Department of Labor, because just like the National Labor Relations Board, OSHA gets a lot of complaints from workers when they've been discriminated against for raising concerns, which they have a right to do under the law, raising concerns about their health and safety regarding COVID, or saying we can't do this job because we think it's sort of an imminent danger. But, you know, the sad thing is that OSHA's received over 1,000 federal OSHA of these complaints and has already dismissed over half of them. You know, just close the case, just dismiss them, just decided that workers didn't have a case. And they've only settled 35 cases so far of the 1,000 that they've received, with a little something for the worker. So you can see that there isn't vigorous enforcement. And also, the laws are really weak when it comes to protecting workers.
Now, the laws, have they changed any when it comes to protecting workers under the Trump administration, or has this been a gradual process over the years at OSHA?
Yeah, we've known for a long time that the OSHA law is very weak in two fronts. One is under the OSHA law, if there is a safety and health hazard in your workplace, all you can do is file a complaint with OSHA. And if, like now, under the Trump administration, they decide we're not doing inspections, then that's it. You have no other rights. You can't sue under the law to get the employer to comply with the OSHA law and the standard. You have no rights to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And when it comes to being discriminated against, workers also don't have the right to sue the employer if they've been unfairly discriminated. They have to go through an OSHA process. And so in this administration, they are just not enforcing the law. They, in fact, it's a myth. They're just spouting things that have no basis in truth. I just saw an editorial by the acting principal secretary of OSHA, a woman named Lauren Sweat, who said that they are investigating, 8,000 OSHA complaints. But the truth is, they are not actually doing what they're supposed to do, and that is on-site inspections. They've gotten over 8,000 complaints, and so far their website, which isn't quite up to date, said 6,000 of them, they didn't even do an inspection. They just closed the case. They sent a letter to the employer saying, please investigate yourself, and they closed the case. And guess what? In many of these workplaces afterwards, the COVID-19 ran through the workplaces and infected workers, and even workers died. And so you can see how OSHA has failed.
Wow. Do we have any numbers on what's going on in America? And I'm referring to data collection on this. And I'm just wondering if that's the missing link here. It seems to me there's, I mean, look at how many government agencies there are today over the years. And everybody seems to collect data. You've got census people. You got the Bureau of Labor Statistics. There's a lot of data there. The Commerce Department has data. We're in the middle of a pandemic right now. Wouldn't you think that there has to be some kind of data collection on who's getting sick, what industries? I mean, we know about meatpacking, any kind of a close contact situation. But what do we know about that data collection, Debbie?
So I think it's sort of stunning because the Centers for Disease Control could require that, you know, whenever there's a test being given, that they have to collect the information. Were you working? Where were you working? And also, you know, when people die of COVID, but there is no requirement to do that. So any of the data that is being collected is really being done sort of ad hoc. I was just on a webinar about the meat and poultry industry, and many states are actually collecting data about the exposures and the case numbers and the deaths in meat and poultry plants, and they're not mm-hmm. making it public at all. And so what you have is data on the communities that have high rates and the states that have rates. And then you have to sort of look back at what are the industries there. I mean, for example, only 21% of cases report whether somebody was a healthcare worker or not. And among those cases of the 21% of testing, we have 34,000 hospital workers sickened and 450 deaths. And that is since like May 14th, which is when they started collecting this data. We know that, and that's nursing home workers. We know that 114,000 hospital workers, have been infected and nearly 600 have died. And that, again, is only from 21% of the total data pool. The 34,000 sickened and 440 dead is from nursing home workers, which started having to report in the middle of May. So we don't know anything about cases before that. And this is, data that's about 2.5 weeks old. We know that over, 40,000 meatpacking and food processing workers have COVID, but many states aren't reporting the data. We know at least 200 have died. But again, many states are not reporting the data. We know from news reports, it's, going around in warehouses and seafood plants, transit workers, grocery stores, correctional officers. So thank God for the media for reporting all this.
So you're saying a lot of this didn't start until May, and the pandemic officially started, I believe it was like middle of March. So you got half of March, all of April, and then going into May. That's when they decided to start, and this was a state-by-state thing, nothing from the federal government? Is that what I'm hearing here?
So just to be clear, for nursing homes where there were huge outbreaks, the federal government, the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services, CMS, they required nursing homes for the first time to report this information to them. So the nursing home data is from May 14th, and there's a huge amount of workers and patients sick and die. The other data is like just whatever has been reported, and a lot of states aren't being reported it. So the data in meatpacking and the data in healthcare workers is just the state. Is just the meatpacking data is by the Food Environmental Reporting Network. The government is not putting out any really reliable data on this at all. And in terms of hospital workers, only 20% of the testing given to the whole sort of healthcare industry is even reporting this information of whether hospital workers have been infected and how many have died. So we know there are hundreds of thousands of workers have gotten it. We know thousands have died, and then it spreads back out into their community. And we know that there's significant, a lot of the big outbreaks start in the workplace. And as the main point here is that if you want to prevent the spread of COVID-19 in the community, you have to protect workers and stop the spread at work.
Yeah. 20%. That's atrocious. Have you had the opportunity to check? I know you're really busy, but what you described as to what's going on in the United States is abominable. But what about other countries? I mean, this is a global pandemic. Are you hearing any information from other countries on how they are responding and protecting workers. I would imagine in places like China, especially communist countries, it's hard to get that kind of information. But I'm wondering, maybe Western civilizations, what are you picking up on that so far, and what kind of job they're doing as far as at least trying to get a handle on this thing and find out what needs to be done?
So we communicate, and I communicate regularly with like my counterpart over in Europe, advocates that works with unions and workers to promote workplace health and safety. And we share a lot of information back and forth. And, you know, first of all, a lot of these countries, you know, they have a much higher percentage of their workforce is union. And so, you know, the unions are much stronger. And so they're able to force companies to implement sort of, you know, 2-meter social distance, masks, stepped up sanitation. And I think that you also see, like in Amazon, in France, where the workers walked out to demand certain protections. And you see in Germany, the government coming in to demand that the meat companies there protect workers and implement all these basic safeguards. Whereas in the United States, you have the administration issuing some kind of executive order that the industry, meat industry, requested, purportedly that says that these plants can stay open even without any safety precautions, even though there's a spread of COVID-19 at work. The executive order actually doesn't do that, but that's what has been reported that it does, and that's what the industry tells workers. Oh, you have to stay here because you have an executive order that we don't have to implement all these protections, and you have to stay here at work, and if you leave, I'm going to fire you. So there's really sort of a difference in just how, you know, European countries are looking at protecting workers than they are here.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the union difference there. No doubt about that. Union density is much, much higher, especially in the European countries. Debbie, can you stay with us for another segment? I want to talk about what's going on in specific states. I know Michigan, for one, as well as Virginia, are taking this very seriously. If we can address that. And also, what recourses do workers have? I know it's limited, but there's got to be a few. Can we do that in the next segment?
You bet.
Debbie Berkowitz is her name. She is the Worker Safety and Health Program Director on behalf of the National Employment Law Project. You want to get some more information from that organization, great organization out of Washington, NELP.org, NELP.org. We'll continue the conversation right after this. Once again, you're listening to America's Workforce.
You're listening to America's Workforce with Ed Flash Ferens.
LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, is the most progressive, aggressive, and fastest-growing union of construction workers, and one of the most diverse and effective unions representing public service employees. LIUNA members are on the forefront of the construction industry, a sector that is a powerhouse of 12 million workers producing 5% of our country's economic output, a 500,000 strong. We're united through collective bargaining agreements which help us earn family-supporting pay, good benefits, and the opportunity for advancement and better lives. With Mobile Action LIUNA, you can get updates on your cell phone, find out how to sign petitions, and download union ringtones. Be a part of your union's political and organizing efforts by sending a text message on your cell phone with the word LIUNA to the number 69866. Through the LIUNA Action Network, you can stay informed about your union with a one-minute update and action alerts.
The United Steelworkers of America represent over 70,000 workers in the state of Ohio. Steelworker members enjoy the benefits of some of the best contracts of any workers in the world. Many of your friends, neighbors, and relatives are members of one of the most effective democratic unions in our country. With the pressures unorganized workers are under in today's economy, you need to join them. So call the Steelworkers Organizing Office at 216-292-5683 or toll free at 1-800-443-3752.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And we're back. It's America's Workforce, and you can get us on various platforms, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, iHeartRadio. Make sure you subscribe to our podcast. Listen to the show Monday through Friday. And once you get hooked, give us a rating. 5-star rating would be greatly appreciated. Let's go back to our live line. Rejoin Debbie Berkowitz. Debbie is the Program Director for Worker Safety and Health for the National Employment Law Project. She's been there since 2015, following 6 years serving as Chief of Staff and then Senior Policy Advisor for the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. And today's show is all about the safety of workers. And we're addressing this all week because this is Safety Week here on America's Workforce. Debbie, you had the opportunity to run down some numbers, and as accurate as they can be, you mentioned in the first segment that a lot of this data has been ignored, not collected. Where are we right now? Maybe you can run down some of the statistics you came up with.
Sure, you bet. So workers across the U.S. economy have been hit very hard with COVID-19 infection. And the problem is, to get an accurate number, is that the Centers for Disease Control is not conducting any real surveillance of where the outbreaks are occurring in plants. They're not, asking states to collect this data or testing sites, and they're not then having all this, whatever data people have, sort of reported in, and they're not reporting it out. So what we do know is some data that CDC has released. They started looking at hospital workers and healthcare workers who've been infected with COVID-19, and only 21% of all the data that could have been reported actually came in. So that's one-fifth of the data that should have been reported. We know as of 3 weeks ago that, 114,000 healthcare workers have been infected with COVID-19, and nearly 600 have died, and that's just one-fifth of the data that we were supposed to get. So you can sort of multiply here. We know that since March 14th, nursing homes have started reporting this data, and they have 34,000 staff sickened and over 500 dead. And we know from environmental groups who are looking at meatpacking plants and looking at news reports, even though many states not reporting, that over 40,000 meat and poultry workers are infected and many hundreds have died. And we also know we've seen spread among warehouse workers, grocery stores, correctional offices, and bus drivers, so you see outbreaks in other industries as well.
And because there's been a lack of enforcement on behalf of OSHA, we're seeing states pick up the lead. I know Virginia, for one, and Michigan, these are the standouts from what I understand. What are you hearing on that? Is this going to be the trend since the federal government is not doing its job with regard to worker safety?
Yeah, thank goodness from the states and the governors in those states that have stepped forward, because the federal government has totally failed workers here. So if you're in a state with federal OSHA, like Ohio or New York or New Jersey or Illinois or Mississippi or Alabama or wherever you're listening, OSHA's not really enforcing the law. They're doing hardly any inspections with COVID-19. They haven't issued any requirements that employers, must implement to protect workers. So the state governors in like a dozen or so states have stepped forward to really protect workers. In Virginia, they passed an emergency temporary standard that's enforceable by their Virginia OSHA. They have a state OSHA that they can, implement protections, required protections for workers. In Michigan, Minnesota, Oregon, Washington, they have, and in California, they have, by executive order, implemented protections to protect workers. California actually had a standard already existing to protect healthcare workers. Then you've got states like Illinois, where the federal government usually has jurisdiction, and the governor stepped up and came out with executive orders to protect workers at work. It's, requiring social distancing, requiring masks, requiring stepped up sanitation so that workers are protected, when they walk in the door.
And, you know, over the years, we talked about this in the first segment, worker safety has been compromised. You know that. We all know that. But the pandemic has shed a whole lot of light on the situation. You would think the government would do the right thing in the middle of a pandemic, step up and say, okay, this is what we need to do to protect workers. We're talking about their health. We're talking life and death situations, but that's not happening. My question to you, for the average worker listening right now, what recourse, other than a union? Now, we know when you're in a union, you have union protections. But what recourse does he or she have in the workplace today in light of what you just told us?
So workers have limited rights. You don't have a right like to sue the employer if they're not enforcing the OSHA law, you know, if they're not providing safe conditions. You can't enforce the law yourself by going out and suing. The only recourse workers have is to file a complaint with OSHA, and I strongly encourage you to do that. You file a complaint, you can go online at www.osha.gov and look down for it says worker rights and click on it, and it'll tell you how to file a complaint. Or you can go to the website of your state and see if the state has anything on there. But I would go to www.osha.gov, you know, look for worker rights, and then click on the complaint and file a complaint and sign the complaint. And you can tell the OSHA, and they will not, you know, they will comply that you don't want your name given to the employer, and file a complaint with OSHA. Now, of course, they're failing. Federal OSHA is failing to inspect the workplace. But at least you have filed a complaint, and if OSHA does nothing, in 2 weeks, file another one. Also, I would contact your local health department, and especially if there are outbreaks, or especially if you've heard people at work getting sick and nobody's been informed. Because if you're not protected, the community isn't protected, and it will continue to spread. And so I would contact your local health department, and I will also contact your governor's office and your elected officials and sort of let them know. I mean, I think that you need to do what you can, because no worker should have to sacrifice their health for a paycheck.
Oh, I hear you. I was reading recently that you warned that passing new standards, and I know that's going to be tough, especially with this administration, passing new standards won't be easy. Politics is complex, and corporate interests will fight tooth and nail against new workplace protections. However, as you pointed out, people's lives are in the balance. It would be government malpractice not even to try. So it would be good. You just have to keep the fight going. Try hard. As you indicated, those of you listening right now, if you see something wrong in your workplace, you have to speak up. You have to file that complaint. I know your job might be in jeopardy, but your life is in jeopardy when you take a look at the whole situation. So it sounds like you're going to be busy for a while here. I know you've been busy. It's been hard to track you down. You seem to enjoy what you're doing, though. Is that what I'm hearing through this conversation, Debbie?
Well, I think we're at a moment in time. You know, I've been doing this work for 40 years. I was the health and safety director way back in a department of the AFL-CIO, then the United Food and Commercial Workers Union. And I really, you know, truly believe that employers need to provide a safe workplace, that's good for them. It's good for workers. It's good for the community. You know, it saves lives and it saves money. And what is so stunning to me is this is the first time in my 40-year history of doing this work that I've seen really an administration decide not to protect workers. And so it's just stunning. I mean, even Ronald Reagan, he ran on a platform to get rid of OSHA. And of course, that didn't happen, thank goodness. But
right.
Even he went after bad acting industries, and even he enforced the law. So, you know, I think, you know, we need to demand that workers need protection. You know, right now on Capitol Hill, McConnell has introduced a bill that, if you can believe this, would prevent OSHA from citing any employer for the next 4 years regarding if they fail to protect workers from COVID-19. And I kid you not. So I just think that we need to make sure that our voices are heard, that worker voices are heard. You have the right to a safe workplace. And just because this administration has decided not to enforce the law, that doesn't mean you don't have these rights. And we need to continually to speak up and get it out to the press and make sure that people understand what's happening.
and vote. We're going to throw that one in there. That's my point of view. I'm sure that's yours as well. But I'm going to leave it on that note. Debbie Berkowitz, Program Director for the National Employment Law Project, dealing with worker safety. Thank you so much for your time, your dedication. I want to drive people to the website again. It's NELP.org, Twitter handle, at Debbie Berkowitz, at Debbie Berkowitz. You take care. Please keep in touch with us and keep up the fight, okay?
Okay. It's been great being on, and so nice to connect with your audience. So take care.
Thank you. All right. That's it for another edition of America's Workforce. Coming up tomorrow, the latest from the American Federation of Government Employees and the Iron Workers. Until then, all of you have a safe and wonderful day.
That concludes another episode of the America's Workforce Radio Podcast. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe so you never miss a show. America's Workforce is a production of Labor Tools and BMA Media Group. Find out more information online at labortools.com.